Hello, I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop, and this is the Meet Cute Book Pod. Today, we have my chat with author Cullianne Bradley, whose debut novel, The Ministry of Time, which she somewhat jokingly describes as a time travel romance about empire, bureaucracy, and cigarettes, was out May 7th. Cullianne talks about the theatrical production that made her start writing again, the experience of being a debut author, how she thinks about this book in relation to genre, how her lockdown obsession with the TV show The Terror became a complicated novel about a footnote of a historical figure, the ways in which writing this book influenced her thinking about mixed-race identity, a bit about her other job, being an editor with Penguin Classics UK, and how that's influenced her writing process itself, the ways in which this book uses time travel as a metaphor for migration, a sneak peek at what she's working on now, and of course, she shares some books she's loved recently. Before we transition to that conversation, a little about Cullianne. Cullianne Bradley is a British-Cambodian writer and editor based in London. Her short fiction has appeared in Some Such Stories, The Willow Herb Review, Electric Literature, Catapult, and Extra Teeth, among others. She was the winner of the 2022 Harper's Bazaar Short Story Prize and the 2022 V.S. Pritchett Short Story Prize. And now, through the magic of podcasting, here's my conversation with Cullianne Bradley. Hi, it is so great to have you. I'm so excited to chat.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I usually start out by asking people a little bit about their background reading genre romance. We're going to talk about genre and this book a little bit later, but since this is a romance podcast, do you read much genre romance?
I actually don't. There's a really big gap in my knowledge, and I think it's something that obviously appeals to me as someone who's written a book centered on a romance. But I tend to read a lot of, and I'm putting these in inverted commas, people can't see this on the screen, but literary fiction. I mean, what does that mean? And where does romance stop and genre fiction stop and literary fiction begin? I'm never very clear on it. But my reading background isn't that. But I did, because I was so excited for this podcast and in preparation, I thought I'm going to read two authors who I think of as romantic comedy writers, actually. So I read Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld, which I thought was so much fun. And then, perhaps foolishly, I read Heartburn by Nora Ephron, because I thought Nora Ephron, the great writer of, rom-coms, so witty, so fun. That is not a romantic comedy. It is a devastating, beautiful book, and it moved me so much. And I know I'm going to read much more of her now, but I really played myself there.
A little bit. I mean, still a great book, still a great choice.
Still a great book.
All right. Well, did you always want to be a writer?
So I remember when I was, a kid and a teenager, I'd have fun making up stories, but I don't think I ever thought of myself as a writer. I came to writing in a very indirect, wiggly way, which is I didn't write for most of my 20s when I was at university, except academic papers. And then I went to a theatre production, a Punch Drunk theatre production in London, 11 years ago now. And do you know much about the production company Punch Drunk?
I do, but it's because of my theatre background. So please explain for the book people.
Absolutely. So Punch Drunk is a British company who specialise in immersive theatre. So they take over a building and they fill all the rooms, and each of the rooms becomes part of this world they've created. And you enter this building and you're immediately part of this world. You're completely immersed in it. And the performers in this world move freely throughout the space. They're mostly trained dancers, some of them are actors, and an audience. As soon as you enter the space, you can choose to follow whoever you want. You can choose to follow no one. You can choose to just enter rooms and explore the set. It's like being in a video game almost, or it's like being in a dream, I prefer to say. I was very, very interested in dance, and I don't think I ever would have made it as a dancer, but it's a dream that was very difficult to not dream. So I'd gone to this production. I'd seen these dancers moving around the space. I was so overwhelmed by the experience. When I came out, I just thought, oh God, I have to create something, because if I don't, I may as well just turn into a chair. Like, this is that I don't know how to be in the world if I'm not doing something as beautiful as that, or at least trying to achieve something as beautiful as what I've just experienced. So because it was the only avenue I thought was open to me and the only one that I'd ever really excelled at in an academic context, I started writing short stories. And progressively over the years, I got stories published and then started getting more attention and eventually got around to writing this novel.
Fascinating. Was it Sleep No More?
It wasn't. It was called The Drowned Man, which never left London. But I have seen the New York Sleep No More, which, like, again, it's what an experience. My God. Have you seen Sleep No More?
Yeah, that was when I was like at peak theater person.
Good thing to hit you when you're peak theater, I think.
Yeah, it was great. I was in New York for a summer doing a theater internship in college and went to Sleep No More and was like, well, that was cool. I was into that.
Oh my God, it's so good. Sleep No More is wonderful. I'm very sorry it's closed in New York now, which is a real shame. But it's still open in Shanghai.
What did you study in college?
English literature.
Okay. So, like, you had, you're a book person.
Definitely a book person, definitely a very enthusiastic reader. I've always been a reader. My mother has a story of me at 2 years old. She just used to, because she had me and then she had my sisters who were twins 2 years after me, which meant she had a toddler and then two babies. So she would put me in the living room and surround me with books. And apparently I was just very happy just looking through these books. So there we are. My mother very much takes credit for all of this.
Man, I am glad you were really into the books, because having a toddler and twin babies sounds really hard.
It was a lot of work, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, this, as you mentioned, is your debut novel. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's incredible, which is like rude because it's a debut. How has the debut experience been for you?
Very, very kind of you to say that. Thank you. It's been completely bonkers. It has been the most bonkers thing that's ever happened to me. And I was warned by other writers, like, there's just no way you won't have a bonkers time. There's no way you won't feel slightly crazed the whole time. It's so normal. And I was like, sure, I can process that when that happens. No problem. I'll be fine. No, it feels every single day I wake up and it feels like my skull has been unhinged. And that's not, you know, it's not a negative experience. But it's an intense experience. It's very, very intense. And because when I originally wrote this novel, in a very different context, I wasn't planning to write a novel. I was writing it for a group of friends. So I was expecting an audience of 5 to 15 people. So knowing that it's going to have more than 15 readers, I hope, is like a strange, like quite a vulnerable thing, actually. It's quite vulnerable to put a lot of that into the world, and for people to eat, they might understand it, they might vibe with it, they might feel sympathetic towards me, or they might hate it. And there's, like, you know, nothing you can do about that. And, you know, it's very fair to hate a book. So yeah, very weird, vulnerable, bonkers making.
Yeah, 20, 30 people might even read it.
Oh my God, can you imagine 30 readers? 30 readers. What if I get 40? I'll lose my gourd.
I feel like there's a lot in this book that people will like want to talk about, which is probably a very strange feeling.
Well, I'm really glad that you have read it and presumably come away with the feeling this could be interesting to talk about, rather than, well, that was boring.
It's definitely not boring. I feel like that's not, like, you can think whatever you want about like any book, really, but if you read this and come away with that was boring. So for people who haven't read it yet, which like is probably most people because it comes out May 7th and we're recording before May 7th, can you just talk a little bit about the premise of Ministry of Time?
Absolutely. So the Ministry of Time, which I sometimes describe as a time travel romance about empire, bureaucracy and cigarettes, which is a tagline that makes people really pause and frown.
No, that's actually very accurate.
It opens on Graham Gore, who was a real historical figure. He was a Victorian polar explorer, and he was part of a doomed expedition. So he's trudging along through the Arctic tundra on this doomed expedition, though he doesn't know it's doomed yet, when the world splits open in front of him and he is dragged from 1847 and the Arctic into a government laboratory in the 21st century. There he's told, hello, welcome to the future. Everyone you've ever known and loved is dead. The British Empire is collapsed. You now have to live in the 21st century, whether you like it or not. We're running an experiment to see if time travel is possible. So whether it will affect your body, whether it will affect, you know, the fabric of space-time. So we need you to assimilate to the 21st century. To help you do that, we're going to assign you this person called a Bridge. And the Bridge, as she is only ever known, is the book's narrator. She has to live with Graham Gore for a year. She has to monitor him. She has to help him assimilate to the 21st century. She has to report on him. She has to develop a very personal relationship with him. And she already has some quite complicated relationships. She's a mixed race woman. She's British Cambodian, as I am. So she has a very complicated relationship with her heritage, with the trauma of the Khmer Rouge, with the inherited trauma that she has to deal with. She has as a mixed race white passing person, she has a very complicated relationship with the British state, with power, with this idea of power and control. And obviously she lives with this very dashing, charming Victorian man. She ends up having a very complicated relationship with him. So as they draw closer, the world around them becomes stranger and more dangerous, and they start to discover the truth about this project that's brought them together.
And what of all the different threads in that was the first thing that sort of interested you? Like, where did you start with this book?
Absolutely with Graham Gore. And I know that your listeners can't see this, but there is a picture of him just over my shoulder here. When I was during lockdown 2021, I was watching a TV series called The Terror, which is about this lost expedition to the Arctic. So the British Navy sent two shiploads of officers and men to try and discover a way through the Arctic. For the good of the trading of the United Kingdom. And all of those men and both of those ships just vanished. They vanished in the Arctic. They never came back. They were declared dead. And it's not really a mystery because we have now worked out what happened, but for many, many years, it was a huge mystery. And it was kind of mythological status in the kind of British historical imagination. So I was watching this TV series. I was having a great time, but I was having quite a lot of difficulty following it, because it was locked down. My brain was made of cheese. It was just complicated. So I went on a fan wiki to just check. You know how when you're on your phone and you're watching TV and you're like, I will just look at my phone, love my phone, delicious, beautiful phone. Just have a look at my little phone and see what's going on. So I was looking at my phone to make sure that what had happened in the first episode had in fact happened. And I saw this name, Graham Gore. He's a very minor character in the series. It was just on a blooper list. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'm on my phone. Love my phone. Beautiful phone. Why don't I look up the name Graham Gore? Went to his Wikipedia page. Just immediately thought, this guy is amazing. I'm obsessed with him. This guy's my new obsession. I've got nothing else to do. I can't leave the house. I'm going to think about this man, Graham Gore, all the time. So that's where it started.
You know what? I think a lot of really excellent literature comes out of very niche obsessions.
I really think you're right. I feel like you can really tell when an author has been like, this is my world now. I'm the senior manager of liking this stuff. And here's a whole book about it.
Yes. And then you're like, how was the research? Was it so difficult and intense? And people are like, so the research was an accident.
Exactly. Exactly. You just don't mean to go down these rabbit holes. It just happens. You're Alice. You're falling. Yeah. It just happens.
And then you have a great book. Speaking of the book, it kind of defies genre categorization. I feel like maybe that's what literary fiction is. Maybe they're just like, we don't know. So like, we'll just call it literary fiction and people can just like.
I wonder actually that maybe that's the trick.
But it's like, it's science fiction. It's like a spy thriller. There's romance. It might be climate fiction. How do you think about it?
Such a good question. And I think I slightly cop out with literary speculative fiction or literary sci-fi, because literary fiction can mean, as you say, almost anything. You can stretch that to mean so much. And what does it mean really? I'm going to say I use it to mean writing where I admire the style, the form. There's something about the way it is crafted that is exciting to me. But because that's true of so much genre fiction as well, you know, it's a cheeky definition. Because when I was writing this, I was writing it for just a group of friends. I wasn't thinking with genre markers in mind at all, because I wasn't expecting this would ever be a book, which may be why I felt so free to play with all these genres.
Yeah, because you weren't trying to figure out like how to sell it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
A lot of authors will talk about, like, you know, you're not trying to write to market necessarily, but also like this is your job and you do need to get paid, and you only get paid if somebody buys the book, and then lots of people buy the book. So
definitely. And then the way it's marketed, you know, they pull out tropes that they know that will appeal to readers. And I understand why there is an urge to write with a genre in mind, even if they're not writing, you know, they're not writing to spec, but they're writing with an audience in mind, certainly. And like wanting to reach and wanting to communicate with that audience involves a certain amount of thinking about genre tropes.
It is being marketed in a really interesting way. I think it's definitely being marketed, at least to me, which makes sense as a romance bookstore owner, but it's being marketed as a romance, which I wouldn't necessarily like. I'm going to stock it in our romance adjacent section, but mostly because I have fear of reader expectations for authors.
No, I think that's absolutely fair. And I think I don't know what the exact number is, but I remember a few years ago, 2016, there was a figure that was, there are 185,000 books published in the UK alone every year. So as a reader, you do want, if you want a genre romance, you want to be picking up a genre romance, right?
I don't know. Have you had any conversations with marketing about like how to pitch it, or that's sort of like none of your business, not your problem?
It's been really, really interesting. So it's been interesting because my literary agency, which is a UK-based literary agency called Aitken Alexander Associates, is a literary fiction agency. They are a small boutique agency and they exclusively deal with non-fiction writers, and all their fiction is literary fiction. So when it was being sent out, the relationships that editors at publishing houses have with agents meant that they understood that what they were getting was something that was coming from a literary fiction sort of starting point. It's only when you start having to explain the book that you think, okay, well, it has time travel has to have happened in the book for it to make sense. There's no actual time travel on the page, but it does require time travel to exist. So it's science fiction. The central story is this relationship between this Victorian man and this 21st century civil servant. The book has formed around that. That's a romance. But it's also, as you say, it's about climate crisis and the future of our world. So like, is it climate fiction? What do you do? And then you ask your author, and your author cries and says, I don't know, I didn't mean to do this, I'm so sorry.
Well, I feel like it's gonna find its people, because
I hope so. The 40 people, the 40 readers.
It's so unusual, I think, and it contains so many things. But it is really interesting from like a book selling and marketing perspective. How do you tell people what this is in a way that like it will find its people?
Yeah, exactly. I really like that there is a romance adjacent place that it could go in your bookshop, because that feels like a really nice angle, because it's not just that it's romance and also romance plus. It's like it suggests there's a kind of bouncing off point. And I love that. I love that idea that it's stocked in a way that encourages your readers, your buyers to kind of bounce off new ideas.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned when you were describing the premise that Graham Gore is a real historical figure. There's not a ton that's known about him, but there is some. How did you approach fictionalizing a real person?
So this was really fun. And I do think when you have a character, when you have a historical figure about whom not very much is known, you can get away with a whole lot more, because I essentially invented this man's character, which is, so like the Graham Gore that you get in the Ministry of Time is a fictional character. He's not the historical figure. He's very, very different. So partly it was picking out bits of his biography that interested me, that charmed me. So there's a moment in someone's letter writing from a ship where he describes Graham Gore. He's smoking a cigar and he's fishing over the edge of the ship. And this image just charmed me so much. I was like, right, I'm making this man a chain smoker, because I just want to have that image constantly. There are examples of him reacting very calmly, even with a sort of ironic playfulness to moments of great disaster. So there's a point where he's in Australia when he's a younger man, and he's shooting a bird and it explodes in his hands, throws him on his back. And he's so startled, his hand is bleeding, it's all gashed up. He comes around and the first thing he says in a very quiet voice is just, "Oh, killed the bird." And I just thought this was so, like, so funny. I imagined this very, like, calm, ironic, competent man. And I just started building it out from there. And part of it was just, I was fascinated by this person. There was almost no archival material. As you say, there are two existing letters. He turns up in other people's letters and diaries sometimes, but because he is such a minor figure in history, there's no reason for there to be archival research. There's no reason for there to be a lot of attention paid to him. It meant that if I wanted to spend time with this person, if I wanted to, like, think about how he would talk, I would have to write his end of the script. In many ways, writing this book was just me wanting to spend time with this person who didn't exist and having to write their end of the conversation.
That's very charming. It's maybe the proper genre is, like, literary fan fiction.
Literary fan fiction! I love that! Yes!
So there's other historical stuff in this book. There are sections about the Arctic expedition. Is that largely based on, is there, like, archival evidence of what happened such that that's based on primary source research?
So we don't know at all what happened on the Franklin expedition. Well, we know, but we only know from Inuit testimony and from extrapolation on what archaeological evidence we've managed to find, because they don't have any, we haven't found any of their documents from at the time. So we don't know what actually happened to them. We only know things like they tried to abandon the ships and march across the Arctic. They all starved to death. They died. A grim time. They ate each other. It was terrible. But there were a number of other Arctic expeditions happening at the time, because the British Empire was very keen to find this route through the Arctic to get to the trading kingdoms of Asia. So they were sending Arctic expeditions up there. And then when this one disappeared with 129 men, they were like, we should probably send some search parties, I guess. So then a bunch of other boats went up, also got stuck in the ice, also ended up trapped, also had to, like, be rescued. It was really like a clown car thing up there. It was really very silly. But because most of those expeditions came home intact, or mostly intact, with evidence, with written journals, with letters home, I was able to kind of build out from that what might have happened on this expedition. So there is absolutely no historical evidence, for example, that what Gore does on the expedition, which sets off a series of events, actually happened. But it did happen on another expedition, which is where I took it from.
Interesting. I can only imagine that Inuit testimony being like, yeah, you should not come back here. This seems bad.
They were so baffled. One of the very first meetings, like, I think 30 years before this expedition, William Edward Parry went up, and he met, you know, the ship met this group of traveling Inuit, and the Inuit were like, why are you dressed like that? Where are your women? What are you doing? Are you guys okay? And, you know, they did try to help as best they could. We know these men from the Franklin expedition who had to march across the Arctic, but, you know, it's a subsistence landscape. There's a limit to what you can do. And if you turn up very badly prepared, just with the arrogant belief in white supremacy and the fact that you know, the British pluck will get you across the Arctic, of course you're going to die. What a stupid thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like they must have just been like, wow, like, these people are not smart.
Not smart at all. And so, so prejudiced, so bigoted that they wouldn't do things like wear the same kind of clothes as the Inuit, which, you know, the Inuit have lived there for hundreds of thousands of years. Of course they know how to survive in this landscape and how to dress properly, because they had to wear their uniforms. They had to have rank. They had to prove that they were part of this empire. And, like, you sweat into wool, it gets heavier, it doesn't dry, you're in the Arctic, you become exhausted wearing it, it rots, you stink. It's so stupid. It's so stupid.
Attachment to the trappings of the British Empire through clothing that just really is your downfall in any other climate.
It's so baffling. Also, this idea that you're attached to quote-unquote civilization, that somehow your trappings are civilization, but, like, that is ridiculous. Your civilization is just part of your habits and social codes that are very dependent on your placement. The civilization of the Arctic is completely different to yours, and you need to adapt to it or you will die.
Well, they learned that one the hard way.
They learned that one the hard way.
So in addition to Graham Gore, there are other people in this book who are from other time periods. I'm trying not to be like super spoilery. You call them expats, which as a former immigration lawyer is like a fascinating and loaded term. But were any of those inspired by real people? Did you just get to sort of invent them whole cloth?
They were completely invented. So the two of the main expats, the expats that the reader will see the most of, I wanted to pick time periods that loom very large in the British cultural and historical imagination, because partly because I was very interested in this idea of history, not as a place that you visit, but as a narrative that tells you about where you've come from, who you're going to be, and how you should obey. It's the kind of narrative that you can conform to, or you can choose to resist. So I wanted to have these two people come from times that are very, very evocative in the British imagination, then to arrive and to not be representative at all. They are their own people. They don't act the way that you might expect someone to act from these time periods. They're not representative of anything. They don't represent Britain. They don't represent history. They don't represent their time periods. They are just themselves. And I really wanted that disruption in expectation.
They're both fantastic. I love them with my whole heart. It was really interesting to, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but to watch the different people from the different time periods perceiving the 21st century and to see which people felt like it had gotten better for them and which people didn't, and also like in what ways. The ways that the world has opened and not opened for different aspects of anyone's sort of being or personality was really interesting.
Thank you. I'm really glad you say so, because I, as you can imagine, I spent a lot of time trying to imagine these people who became my best friends who didn't exist and how they would react.
Yes, I would like Margaret to be my best friend. That would be great, actually.
She is my favorite. She was, because of, I think we can say that she's from the 17th century. So because of that, her language was the hardest to get right, which meant any scene involving her took the longest to write. But what a pleasure to spend time with her.
It tickled the part of my brain that used to be very into Shakespeare.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Amazing. So you spotted Pizzle-Headed Doorknob, which I think I've stolen from maybe Falstaff. I'm not sure.
All right. You have admitted that you're not a huge genre romance reader. This is also a time travel book, although, as you mentioned, time travel is more of a backdrop than like an on-page thing that's like constantly happening. But do you read a lot of science fiction? Do you have any favorite like time travel media, books, TV, movies?
So embarrassingly, again, I actually don't read very much. And it's I know that it's something that I would love when I want to dig into it. I will say that the author I've read the most of and the most consistently is Terry Pratchett, who is a British fantasy author. So his book Night Watch, which is it's about a man traveling back into his own past, is so beautiful and thoughtful, and I think so brilliant about the way that your identity and your sense of self is actually created by the things that happen to you. And it's as much about the kind of legend of yourself and the legend that having to face up to the truth of that legend of yourself as it is about time travel, I think, which is, I just think he's so funny. I love Terry Pratchett. He's such a hilarious man. I also was very fond of Kurt Vonnegut, especially in my 20s, and Slaughterhouse-Five, again, is like, it's a time travel book, but I think it's also very much about the difficulty of processing trauma. And I think you can look at Slaughterhouse-Five and think that the time travel that occurs in this book is also, so, you know, the experience of PTSD. It being constantly thrown back into that traumatic event and constantly reliving it as if it is happening right now, as if your life is permanently on this loop. Although it's not a time travel book, I will say that Time Lived Without Its Flow, which is by the philosopher and poet Denise Riley, was very, very influential on me, because she wrote it in the aftermath of the death of her son. And in it, she describes how your personal experience of time, of moving through time, changes when you suffer devastating grief, because the sense of moving into the future is gone now. You live in a permanent present of loss, of this person no longer being there. And she talks about, as a writer, how often it's even difficult to imagine the end of a sentence, because what's the point of writing? And you live in a world in your own personal time where everyone else is still millia time. And there's a, in the in my book, there's this concept, here-ness and there-ness, which is a personal experience of inner time contrasting with outer time, which was directly inspired by that book.
I feel like I can feel all of those as influences in this book. The book also talks a fair amount about the experience of being white passing from the perspective of the Cambodian British narrator. And publishers will like sometimes send a little author note with an advanced copy of a book. And you have one at the beginning of this, which I don't think will be available to readers who buy it in the store, but I got to read it. I think they should include them. I mean, they're really interesting always. Like, it feels unfair that I get them and other people don't. But other people get part of this one because I'm gonna quote it at you and then ask you a little bit about it. You said that writing this novel was a sometimes quite exposing journey into thinking about mixed-race identity, inherited trauma, and the ways the personal can be political or politicized. Can you talk a little bit more about how the writing influenced your thinking?
Absolutely. So the very, very first version of this book, first two versions of this book, I think, the bridge was not British Cambodian. She was kind of cipher, actually. She didn't really have an identity or a personality. And as I was thinking more seriously about how the book should be structured, it became clear to me that I wanted a mixed-race white passing person, specifically because I wanted someone who would have this ambivalent relationship with the British state, who would be able up to a point to pass as white, to pass as white British, to pass as the dominant power, when in fact they have a very different relationship to that power. I didn't decide to make her British Cambodian. Originally, I was thinking, oh, maybe I should make her British Indian or British Burmese, because both of those countries have histories as colonies, British colonies. Cambodia was a French protectorate, so it was part of the French Empire, not the British one. But then I thought, that's actually very disingenuous, because I am British Cambodian. Why wouldn't I draw on experiences that I have to inform this book? All writers write from, I believe, a certain amount of personal experience. You know, the bridge is not me. I'm a very different person to the bridge. But given that I have these experiences and I can use them, why wouldn't I? So I actually took her out of a different novel I was writing, which will never see the light of day, because I wanted to use her to think about this idea of complications of power. One of the reasons I want to be so clear that the bridge is not me is partly because I think anyone with a marginalized identity who writes a character with this marginalized identity is often told, oh, is this autobiographical in any way? What does this have to do with your family? What does this have to do with you? Which I think is maybe not necessarily relevant for a romance between a civil servant and a Victorian polar explorer, right? I've never had a romance with a Victorian polar explorer, but God damn it, I've tried.
There's still time.
There's still time. You're absolutely right. There's still time. But the bridge in this book makes a series of decisions that I find very problematic, and I want them to be problematic. I want them to be found problematic. And she treats other people who also are marginalized in different ways in problematic ways. And that's because I was very interested in what it means to have the power to pass as white, the privilege, right? The privilege to pass as white, and how you can exploit this power and what responsibility you might have to interrogate that. So a lot of that was going on as I was writing.
You mentioned that was like in draft 3 or something. At what point, I guess, did this become like not a thing you were just writing for your friends and like a thing that you were like, maybe more than 15 people will read this and I should like think about structure?
I wrote the first draft very quickly just for these friends because, it wasn't a book. I was just having fun. So I think it came out in 11 or 12 weeks, just blah, 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 blah. Because I was writing this other novel at the time, which I thought of as my serious literary fiction novel, but it was going horribly, because if you're not having fun, and if you, like, again, I was writing for this idea of a literary fiction audience. Who is that? What does that even mean? So this book didn't work. It was a disaster. And then some of my friends who were reading this, it was not then called the Ministry of Time, has subsequently become the Ministry of Time, said, well, this is a really enjoyable story. This is fun. This has a beginning, a middle, and an end. This has a narrative. It has interesting things about Victorians, about this fish out of water comedy, about imperialism, about all sorts of things. Why don't you think about this as a novel? So I sent a cleaned up version out on submission to agents, but I then had to work on this book with my agent for a year to get it up to standard, and then another three edits with my editors. So what you read is the ninth version of the book.
It took some time.
It would be honestly really offensive if you were like, I wrote this in 12 weeks and I was done. Like, that would be really upsetting to learn.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, thank God we took the version that took 12 weeks to write is not the one that's being published, because, you know, it was fun, but it wasn't good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it didn't have all its ideas, like, fully cooked.
Exactly. It needed some growing.
And again, like, I'm really glad that that's the case, because I would give up, I think, frankly, if this was just, like, a thing you dashed off. Okay, so the other thing about you is that you're also an editor.
I am.
You're an editor at Penguin Classics.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit? I frankly am going to sound incredibly silly, but what do you do when you're editing a classic? Like, what does that mean? What is your job?
No, it's a very, very good question. And it's one that I've only had this job for 3 years, 3 and a bit years. Before that, I was editing contemporary literary fiction. So I've moved into this. And it's a very, very different job. It's quite an unusual job. So very, very reasonable to ask. With publishing existing classics in English, you don't edit. Of course you don't edit. Why would I? I wouldn't be editing Jane Eyre. It's there. It's perfect. I don't need to touch it. But I often also work quite a lot with classics in translation. So books that have been translated from different languages into English, which are classics in their own languages and in their own countries. And for that, it's very much a case of like trying to make sure that the intended impact, the intended language, the intended narrative flow exists in English, and obviously helped in this by brilliant translators who are so gifted and work so hard to bring these books, and who labor to make these books in English. I also do a little bit of nonfiction editing, which is very, very different and is much more sort of structural editing, moving ideas around, moving chapters around.
You are editing in English, and then you have the translator who, how do you even?
So quite often there'll be a case where, you know, I might come across an image that I don't really understand, or I don't understand its intended impact, how it's meant to make the reader feel, or how it's supposed to sit within the scene, for example. And I might say to your translator, like, this is how I'm reading it right now. Is that how it reads in the original to you? Or there might be, you know, an entire scene where you're trying to work out what the intention of the scene is and within the flow of a narrative. And again, you might ask, how, you know, in the original, do you have a sense of how this is supposed to sit? It's really, really fun. And it's a very, very collaborative, I hope, process. I hope that my translators feel like I'm collaborating with them and not being a pain in the ass.
That sounds like a great job. And also, I mean, has that affected your writing? Because I feel like your writing has a lot of really unusual, like, similes and metaphors that are very sort of arresting in the way that they, like, I've never heard anyone describe it that way. It doesn't really make any sense, but also I know exactly what you mean. Like, I have no further questions. I think there's a description of a pub and it's like being inside the elbow of a tweed jacket or something. And like, I don't like what, but also absolutely. Yes. Like, I know I have been in that pub and I know exactly what you mean. How has your work as an editor, like, informed your writing?
That's a really, really great question. And I have to say that when I was editing contemporary fiction, when I was editing, you know, English speaking authors who are still alive and in many cases are absolutely brilliant, I was not writing novels in the same way. I don't think I could have produced this if I was working in the same way on contemporary literary fiction. I think there's only a limited amount of space in my quite small brain to do that. I will say that it has made me a voracious reader. I mean, I've always read a great deal, but I now read a lot of classics, and it is so, it feels so reassuring, and it feels so, what's the word? Affirming, to know that when I write something, I'm not just writing in a vacuum. I'm not just writing because of a marketing trend, say, but I'm part of a chain of writers going back all through history. And I like to hope, I like to imagine that someone might read my book and then feel that it is in conversation with another book. that it's in conversation with other contemporary writers, but also that it's in conversation with past writers. And I like to imagine myself as being a very small part of this very large literary ecosystem. And I hope that at the level of the line you just described, one of my favourite similes, actually, I hope that it feels like it has that kind of large range that it is taking from many, many worlds and many, many visions and many, many possibilities. I hope. I mean, it's a debut novel. It might fail at that.
I don't think so, but I guess everyone is welcome to their own opinions. don't ever look at the Goodreads.
No, you're absolutely right. I haven't looked at it since January, I don't think.
And don't ever look at it again. I haven't looked it up. Not saying there's something bad there. I'm sure that somebody picked it up and was like, the narrator is British and I hate the British.
I hate the British. What does it mean to be inside a pub that's like being in the inside of a tweed jacket's elbow? Like, what does that mean? Gross.
How do you manage to sort of find some like work-life balance when you have two different jobs that are both like very thinking about words intensive?
Part of this is that this is kind of my only hobby. I did quite a lot of actually have ballet and classical Cambodian dance, but most of what I like to do is read. Most of what I like to talk about is books. it's a little bit tragic. So there's that. There's also, and this is such a prosaic but very practical thing, I now work from home part of the week, which means that I no longer have an hour long, you know, I work in London, I have an hour long commute from my house to my office. Suddenly, 2 hours a day when I work from home are freed up. And it literally is that. And it's got to the extent that I have now trained myself, slightly embarrassingly, I can only write for that period of time. And if I go over an hour and a half, my brain starts to go bluff because it's too tired. And it's like, we've come to the end of our commute. No more writing. Go and have some dinner. So it is literally that I have slightly more time. I'm sleeping slightly better because I don't have to get up to get a train. And I feel that this hour, which I would have otherwise spent commuting, is mine. And that really is it.
Well, a better argument for working from home has never been made.
Let them work from home. Otherwise, you won't get more novels.
All right. So you've mentioned this is your debut novel. You have published and won awards for your short stories. And you mentioned you were working on another novel when you sort of like dashed this one off for fun. Had you written novels before? Was this your first like novel you got to the end of?
I have absolutely written novels before. And they were rubbish. They will never see the light of day. I did before I went out with this book, I tried to go out with a different novel. So this is the second book I've ever had trying to find an agent for. The other one went nowhere. No one wanted it because it was bad. But I have also written novel length works. Maybe not necessarily novels. Maybe they're not good enough to even be called that. But I'm never showing them to anyone. They're awful. They're a mess.
I think it seems like most writers have a couple books in a drawer somewhere that like is on the list of things that someone needs to burn if they die.
Yes, exactly. I need someone to take my hard drive and just drive a truck over it back and forth.
How do you find writing in novel length different from short fiction?
Well, the reason that I've written so much short fiction, again, quite variable quality. I think some of the things I've written are good and some of the things I've written are... the reason I write a lot of short fiction is that I start fixating on something. I just can't stop thinking about it. And I'm like, right, I'll write a story about this. For this book specifically, for The Ministry of Time, it was a case that I'd fixated on this dead guy. And it just didn't stop. I thought it was going to be a short story. It just wouldn't stop. It kept getting longer and longer and longer. This is not the case for the other novels I've written. This is the one-off. And I'm slightly worried I'm never going to reproduce this. And this is it. I'm going to be obscure after this. Because it just kept coming. It felt like a short story that would not shut up, frankly.
So I guess, what is your writing process like?
So I have an hour. It's actually more accurate to say that the hour that occurs is not really on my, you know, it's not when I am commuting, it's later in the day. So I sort of procrastinate quite a lot because I don't want to write until the moment I am writing. And then when I'm writing, I'm like, well, I don't want to stop until this hour-long commute comes to an end. And if anyone tries to distract me, I'll bite their arm off. But there is a lot of faffing around, thinking, opening my door, shouting at my partner, I'll never write again, I hate this, standing in the garden, staring at nothing, assuming that I'm just a fool, I'm a clown, and I should never have tried this. Eventually, sit down, stop tapping, itch it. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes I just feel grim. But if it works, it works, and then it just goes. I wonder, do you have a similar experience with writing?
Yes. We had an event for an author a couple weeks ago. She was like, yeah, well, I wrote 2,500 words on the flight. And then she was like, and then I wrote another 2,500 in the lobby because the chair was really uncomfortable. So I just like wanted to get up. But I was like, no, you have to finish this chapter. There are some romance authors who are writing, and you know, it's like a very different book. It's not also a book about colonialism. Like, it's a rom-com. So there's a little bit less like finessing of complicated narrative concepts that's happening in each book. But like, they're publishing like 6 books a year.
Holy crap. Wow.
It's truly wild. Like, so I've talked to people who don't feel that way and people who do feel that way, but
I agree.
In particular for indie books, in order to get paid, like in order to be a full-time indie author, you need to publish a lot of pages.
Right.
But it really is a skill that I think is a little bit devalued. Like, there are many kinds of writing and many ways to write. And like, you get different kinds of books, but it really is like, not anybody could just sit down.
Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right that people think that they can and they assume that they can. It's because they've never actually been tested on this. You know, there is this denigration of people who can produce like commercial, high concept, enjoyable writing. That doesn't just come out of nowhere. That comes with practice, and it is a skill. It, like anything that requires this kind of specialization, is a skill.
I feel like, particularly in the United States, I don't know about in Britain, but we have like low skill worker. Like, we're very bad about deciding that things are like not skilled tasks.
It's also interesting how often this concept of low skill. We do in fact have this, and this often it often means low wage. Right, it has nothing to do with skill value. It's to do with class and wage. That often it's the people that if they remove their labor, you'd have a lot of problems further down the line. It would be disastrous for the so-called high-skilled laborers.
It's also very gendered, where it's like, I think with writing and art, you know, it's like romance novels are women's work.
Yeah, it's women's work. It's only read by women. And it's not read by women properly. You know, women can't read properly, obviously. They're reading this light thing. It's just it's not like the great American novel. So it's not, you know, it's not real writing, which is silly because like obviously the time has gone in to produce it. The book exists and people are reading it with their eyes, with their brains. Like that's a novel.
So you also wrote, I'm going to quote your little letter to the early readers again. No matter how many jokes I plastered over the cracks, I was writing about a country still grappling with its imperial legacy, being handed the means to control history. This caused a lot of problems when I was trying to refine the voice of my narrator. Who did I want her to be? A rebel against the system? If she was a rebel, why did she become a bureaucrat? Perhaps she was an underqualified opportunist, but how could a woman like that feel something as sincere as she does for Graham Gore? At what point in the drafting process, or maybe it was there at the beginning, but when you went from like, fun hypothetical about a polar explorer being your roommate to, oh, I have accidentally started writing something that is like very complicated. How do you process that? Do you talk it through with somebody? Do you write it out? Like, do you just stare at a wall for a long time thinking about it?
Lots of wall staring, lots of going into the dark back room in my head. But as I say, so I was writing this, the very first version of this, for a group of friends, all of whom I'd met because they were also interested in polar exploration. Again, during lockdown, we couldn't go outside, but there's this online community, which meant that if you are interested in British polar exploration, especially Victorian British polar exploration, what you are getting interested in is the work of an empire. There's no way of getting around that. They were not up in the Arctic for like good reasons. They were not doing good things there. So any conversation that you have about these expeditions has to be you can say, you know, I'm fascinated by these people, I'm fascinated by these men, you know, I feel very affectionately towards these men, but you can't shake off the fact that you're also grappling with imperialism. There's just no way around it. So even before I started writing, we were having these conversations, very, very interesting and fulfilling conversations about what drew us to these expeditions and what the truth of these expeditions was. And I think it's the case with many, many interests and hobbies and engaging with any media, there are often conflicts, and that doesn't mean you shouldn't engage with the conflict, but I think it's important to be aware that the conflict is there. I think it can really enrich your experience of reading or watching something. So as I was writing this fun story, I was also thinking about that, and I couldn't not think about it as it developed. What developed much more, which was a much more crunchy development, was what the ministry was, because really I in the first version I just needed a way to get him to the 21st century. So it was just like the sinister ministry, whoa, what's it doing? Oh, it's brought him over. Oh, I guess it's bad because the British state is not great. You know, it mishandled the pandemic, certainly, and so I was quite angry at the time. But having to really start seriously grappling with what the ministry was and what it might want to be doing with these expats. And as you say, this term expat is loaded, because all these expats brought from British history are white. But they are treated as if they're refugees, and the bridge comes from a family where there are refugees in her, you know, her mother is a refugee. And that's a very different word to use about someone who has emigrated. I don't know if this has answered your question. Sorry, I've really gone off on one.
No, but I want to talk more about that. So in immigration law, right, I worked specifically in refugee, like, asylum law. But there was a lot of conversation about the way that, like, when Americans, like, move to Europe, they're expats. And when, like, Mexicans move to the United States, they're refugees, or, like, immigrants or migrants. And the way that we talk about migration really, like, is incredibly racialized. But also, the parallels between being, like, pulled from the 19th century into the present, which is like a forced migration, and having to leave your country because there's an ongoing genocide, which is also a forced migration, is, like, I think a really interesting, I didn't really have a question to ask you about it, but if you wanted to talk more about it, I was super fascinated by that parallel in this book.
I would love to talk more about it. And I'm like, it's actually really great to know that you worked in immigration law, because I feel like that means, you know, you have seen these issues close up, and you've seen the way that language is used to kind of to shape the way we talk about the people that are leaving and coming and how we value them. So yeah, one of the things that I thought a lot about while I was writing is both history as a narrative that informs culture, but also time travel as a kind of metaphor for migration, for being forcibly removed from somewhere and told to assimilate. And this term expat, which is American syrup, or Europeans moving within Europe, or moving to the global south to bring their digital nomad lifestyles or whatever. The idea of the people from the past being expats is linked to this idea of assimilation, which the ministry drives really early on. They want them to assimilate. They want them to be productive. They want them to have jobs. They want them to be useful. They have to be good immigrants, not just, you know, they can't just turn up and be refugees. They have to be good British citizens, and they have to fit this correct mold. And as you know, that not all of them are able to fit this mold or resist it. And that has consequences. The ones that are willing to be exploited for certain physiological effects that come about as a result of time travel are treated in very different ways. And this was also really interesting to me, because at the one of the conversations that was happening at the time of the lockdown, and I imagine was happening in the US as well, was this idea of a good immigrant. There is a wonderful anthology both in the UK and the US called The Good Immigrant, which challenges this idea that you had to be a useful, highly skilled worker, educated, contributing in a really meaningful way to British society. You know, I thought about my mother, who is a brilliant woman, an extremely intelligent, wonderful woman who has, you know, made me the person I am, but she worked in what would be considered a low-skilled job. She was not a doctor. She was not a teacher. And this has always really stayed with me, this idea that there will be people out there who think of her as not a good immigrant. And in the same way, the expats that don't assimilate properly are not good immigrants. What will the British state do to them?
Nothing good. Not in this book. The other thing that I found really interesting about the writing of this, and I almost added when I was talking about genres, like mystery, because there absolutely is like something going on and we don't know what it is. But the narrator does know what it is because she's telling this story looking back. How did you figure out or like assess when to like leave your breadcrumbs, when your revelations would get made, just in terms of pacing of that part of the plot?
It was really difficult, actually. And I had to be totally honest with you, I needed help from my agent and then from both of my editors. I have a US and a UK editor, because sometimes they felt that I was leaving too many breadcrumbs, that I had revealed the twist too early. And sometimes there was the issue of keeping the mystery, the spy thriller plot, alive through what are functionally kind of comedic workplace and comedic fish out of water scenes. And so there was a lot. I know the people on the podcast won't be able to see this, but I can show you one of my draw, which is just absolutely covered in post-it notes as I frantically tried to kind of color code where everything should be. It took a lot of work, and I'm glad you asked that, because I do think it is important to say that I needed an editor. I needed help.
For what it's worth, for me, I didn't guess it, but then when I learned it, I was like, oh yeah, no, I should have figured that one out, which I feel like is ideal, right? Like, you don't actually want to figure it out, but you do want to feel like you should have been able to figure it out.
I'm really glad to hear that, because I think for certainly some of the early drafts, the answer was like right there. And I think it's frustrating because you watch the bridge not getting it and you're like, what's wrong with you? Please, I beg you.
No, she kept being like, I should have been smarter and realized that something was going on. And I was like, me too. I definitely should be smarter and realize that something is going on. All right. Well, if it is not a publishing secret, can you preview what you're working on now or what is next from you? I don't know what your timeline is. In romance, like working on now and what's coming out next are usually different. But I feel like in literary fiction, those might be the same.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely is. I really admire this. Like, it also requires so much faith, I think, from your audience that they'll continue to commit, and that you're in this. I feel like when you're publishing that much, you're in a constant conversation with your readership. I really like that idea. I think that's nice. I am currently working on a second novel, which, because I'm not under contract for it, who knows if we'll ever see the light of day, but it is partly set in the land of a borderland between the land of the living and the land of the dead, and there's a psychopomp there who runs a lighthouse, and it is partly set in contemporary London, where there is a freelance sadist who has fallen in love with someone, but he doesn't know who she is.
Oh, I'm completely sold. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I will read that. If no one wants to buy it, you can just...
I'll just email it to you.
just send it into my inbox. Yeah. Someone will buy it, I feel like. But just in case, before I let you go, can you just recommend a book or two that you have read and loved recently?
Absolutely. And in fact, you very kindly let me preview some of the questions, and I immediately thought, oh, I know there are two books I really, really, really want to recommend, because they are both deeply romantic books in the sense that they are about desire. They are about the friction between wanting something and being kind of repulsed by it or afraid of it. They are very sexy, both of these books. They are very beautiful. They're both queer romances, I think. They have queer romantic elements. So one is The Safe Keep by Yael van der Wouden, which is so brilliant and so devastating. There is a twist in The Safe Keep, which I did not see coming, and it felt like I had been kicked in the stomach. It was so extraordinary. I cannot recommend it enough. And the other one is Land of Milk and Honey by Si Pamjam, which again is just, it's about, it's set in the future, and there's been a kind of collapse of world agriculture, and there's not very much food left, and this cook is made to go to this mountain retreat for the rich and cook with the last resources. Both of these books are just extraordinary, and I cannot recommend them enough.
I will be adding them to my TBR right now. Thank you so, so much. This has been delightful and fascinating. And hopefully everybody who listens will pick up The Ministry of Time, which by the time they hear this will be available wherever books are sold, but also at our bookstore in our romance adjacent section.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun. Thank you for asking such interesting questions. It's been such a pleasure.
And there you have it. A huge thank you to Cullianne Bradley for sharing with us a little of her humor and brilliance. If this conversation has made you want to pick up a copy of The Ministry of Time, you can do that in our shop or on our website, meetcutebookshop.com. And if you've been enjoying this podcast, I would so appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review it on the podcast listening platform of your choosing or share about it on social media. That helps other people find us, and that helps us keep making podcasts. That's all for this episode of the Meet Cute Book Pod. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop in San Diego, California, and I hope you'll tune back in for more deep dives into romance writing, reading, and publishing.